44, and then we go up even more to about 51 on Monday. A chance of showers on Monday, though. 50-50 shot of some shower, so it's likely that you'll see some wet weather, if not in the afternoon, in the evening. Tuesday, rain and snow showers, so it looks like we start going down in temperatures again once we hit Tuesday. But right now, we have 33 degrees. I'm Tracy Morgan in the Next Tier Bank studios. Next Tier Bank, your hometown community bank. And Dave is out today again. I'm going to take the first half hour, and then Tyler's going to be in with the Butler County Commissioners at 1. I'm Tracy Morgan. Thank you for joining us for the news. And I'd say have a nice day. Talk to you in a few. Thanks for joining us, though.
WISR now presents It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey. Dave is off today, so we have a special guest host. It's Your Turn is Butler County's only live call-in talk show. You can join in the conversation by calling 724-283-2525. And now, let's join It's Your Turn and today's special guest host.
Welcome to It's Your Turn. I'm Tracy Morgan, filling in for Dave Malarkey, of course, out for the day. So we are having the Wine Festival. That is coming up in Butler County, and this is the 12th year that we have held this particular Wine Festival. It is such a popular event. We always have two different rooms. We have multiple wineries that come. Great food that you can taste, because who doesn't want food, right? So we got all of that coming up at the Butler Days Inn, and so we're taking some time to talk to the wineries that are going to be with us. And another winery that is coming is Woody Lodge Winery, and with us is Captain John Gailey. John, how you doing today? Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
Well, now, John, this is kind of a family business for you, isn't it?
It is, yes. My mother and stepfather started the business back in 2013 after years of playing around with amateur competitions, getting gold and double gold. So they decided, hey, we got something good here. Let's open up a winery. And so we opened up on November 1st, 2013, here in Cambria County, Pennsylvania.
And so tell me how you get your grapes, how you get the wine. I know I talked to an individual that said, we don't grow them here. The grapes come from elsewhere, but we mix them all up. How is your process done?
So there's a lot of suppliers we get from. Some of them are the same suppliers for Welch's grape juice up towards Erie and Fredonia, New York. We don't have the pressing equipment, so we'll order, say, 275 gallons up to 1,100 gallons of blueberry juice, strawberry juice, and then it gets shipped to us, and then we go through our process of fermentation, changing it into wine, however we would like to do that.
Do you have some favorite flavors?
I was stationed in northern Italy, so I love our Merlots, I love our Pinot Noirs, our more drier reds. But most of our customer base in Pennsylvania loves our sweeter wines, our blueberry, our chocoholic cherry, spiced apple, for instance. All of our fruits are 100% fruit. We don't take a white grape and add in any artificial flavoring or food flavoring. So 100% juice goes into our wines, and that's it.
John, I'm going to come back to the chocoholic cherry in a moment. You mentioned chocolate, cherry, and alcohol. But let me ask you this first, because I did call you captain. You said you were stationed. Tell me about your history. Being in the military, you're still active, and where you got to where you are today.
I graduated from Penn State. I have a Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering from Penn State. I joined the Army back in 2006. I'm currently at Fort Benning, Georgia. I'm transitioning out of the military. I'm getting medically retired. So I decided to put money into my family's business and take over the business and expand it. And so that's why we started looking over towards Pittsburgh for wine festivals, because we have not gone to any festivals in that region as of right now.
And this is a very popular one. So when you come and you bring your wines, are you going to bring a certain selection with you, or are you going to bring the gamut? What do you think that you'll be bringing with you?
Well, we currently have 19 wines. We usually are going to bring about 13 to 14. We have some of our small batches that we keep at the winery for our local customers, like our Pinot Noirs, our Cab Sauvs, like our Private Reserve Merlot. But we'll bring most of them, like our larger batches, our Merlots, all of our fruit wines, our Chardonnays, our Rieslings, and we have a bunch of other sweet wines that people love in the region.
Now,
so we're going to test the market over there.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about dry wines, because I went in my life from liking a sweet wine, fruity wine, to now dry wines. I like just dry red. And so is there like a gamut, if you will, a range of sweetness for the sweet wines as well as the dryness for the dry reds?
Yeah, so when you look at the scale for wines, it depends on how much sugar, residual sugar that's in the wine, determines what range it is for what category, sweet, semi-dry, dry, extra dry. So a lot of ours are sweet. We do have some semi-sweets, like our Riesling is actually like a semi-sweet. It's not a dry Riesling. And then all of our dries are extremely dry.
See, that's
interesting. We have a red grape that most red grapes are dry, but we have a little bit more residual sugar to try to catch you, as the sweet drinker, to bring them down towards where the drier end is. So it's like a catch between wine, and it's called our Chamberson Choo Choo.
See, I'm glad that you're...
We're close to the horseshoe curve, so we decided to have
a
train on the label, and it's called Chamberson Choo Choo. Yes,
with the choo choo sound. You got to have the choo choo sound.
Yeah, some people do in the winery at night when they drink it.
I love it. Yeah, it depends on how much they've had, right? On how loud.
Yeah, usually.
Yeah, right. So and it's interesting when you say Rieslings. When you say there's some dry, there's some not like sweeter. See, I think this is where it gets confusing for me, because I like wine, but I'm not a wine connoisseur. So when you go into a wine store or into like Woody Lodge Winery, somebody like me is going to come in and say, I don't even know what I want to taste. Do you get that a lot from people?
We do, but we have a tasting chart that's broken down by the category of wine, and then it goes from sweet to drier in each category. And then we tell them, okay, usually you want to start with your dry wines and then go into your sweet wines, because it changes your palate as you taste it. And then we're allowed to give 5 free samples. After that, for $5, you can try all 19 wines if you want to.
So when you say we go from dry to sweet, is that recommended when you're taste testing, or is that recommended when you're having a meal?
Well, certain wines pair with certain meals very well, but when you're taste testing, you should go from drier to sweeter.
Drier to sweeter.
Because a sweet palate, when your tongue changes the sweetness of the sugar, then it's going to change the way you taste the drier wine, which has hardly any sugar in it.
See, and I find that interesting, especially when we get to dessert, because for me, I could skip the whole meal and just go dessert. It's dessert and wine, isn't that? See, back to the chocolate, or the, what do you call it, the chocolatier?
It is called our Chocoholic Cherry. It's 100% cherry juice infused with chocolate.
That's excellent. I could just taste it now. I can't wait to get there to taste it. But so here's my question. I don't know if I'd have that one with dessert, but this is my question, because maybe you could correct me. When you get to dessert, whether you're having pie or whether you're having, you know, something that's drizzled with chocolate, and then you have wine with it, would that not cancel out the sweetness? I mean, can you taste both your dessert and your wine together?
You can. So I give the best for instance for people that come to the winery and talk. So my wife takes that Chocoholic Cherry and pours it on top of her ice cream and eats it together.
Oh, okay. That's
so
a very interesting.
And actually, certain ice creams with the Chocoholic Cherry pair very well, like a Haagen-Dazs, like butter pecan, for instance.
So do you have any other kind of infused kind of wine? It's interesting. I'd love to know the backstory of how you get chocolate infused with cherry. But do you have any other flavor combinations?
We do. So if we have, it's called a Strawberry Blast. So our formula wines, those are their two biggest formula wines, are the Chocoholic Cherry and our Strawberry Blast. Our Strawberry Blast, we mix our 100% strawberry juice with a red grape. So usually a Concord, and we blend it together, and it comes out really well. It's a big transition from our 100% cherry wine.
Folks, if you're just joining us, we're talking with John Gailey. He's a captain, I should say, in the military. Woody Lodge Winery is the winery that's going to be one of the many that are coming to our wine festival at the Butler Days Inn. Of course, this is on the 27th of January, and tickets are on sale, so you can get those. If you want to call us about those tickets, it's 283-1500 is our phone number, or, of course, butlerradio.com. You can go there as well and get information, WISR680.com, yet another place to get information and tickets if you're looking for that online. But, John, if we're looking for Woody Lodge Winery, where do we go? Where, again, can we visit? Where do we go online?
Well, we have a woodylodgewinery.net. We have our email. As I started transitioning out of the military, I really got into putting up our Facebook page. So I run our Facebook page. And I started doing pushing our wines out in distribution. So right now we have like Altoona Giant Eagle, the Punxsutawney and Shop and Save, a couple Country Garden Six Pack in Evansburg, and we're pushing our wines out. So if you don't want to come to the winery, here soon we're going to start be pushing into more and more stores throughout the area. So
it's
you want to come to the winery, it's in Asheville, Pennsylvania. I guess coming from Butler, the closest would be 422 towards Evansburg and Crescent area.
Yeah, and that's not bad, too, especially if you're going on vacation this summer or in the spring and you're traveling. Because I know we do that as a family. We try to figure out spots along the way to the destination, and this could be a fabulous place for us to stop. So Woody Lodge Winery, you're coming to our wine festival. So if people can't travel right now, we can just come to you. We'll come to you at the Butler Days Inn. So thank you so much, John, for joining us for a few minutes, and thank you for sharing information about your winery with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for the time. I appreciate it. Can't wait to see you out there for the first time in that area.
So if you are going to be able to come to our wine festival and you want to save yourself some money, let me tell you how you can do that. Because you have premier tickets that are on sale now. They're $20 pre-sale, and there's a limited quantity to that, so make sure you get them. If you can find them at the door, and they are at the door, then they're going to be $25. So make sure that you get your tickets and get them early, because it is just a hugely popular event. Again, the 12th year that we have held this. You have a lot of different wineries coming. We'll be talking to them as we go throughout our days here, too. But there's also a fundraising benefit that's going to be happening for the YMCA, and it's to support their annual campaign. The annual support campaign is exactly what it's called. So when you get there, you're going to have bits of food. You're going to have wine, if this is your first year of joining us. You're going to have wine tasting. You'll have vendors you can buy from. You have different specialty businesses that you can buy from as well. And then you are going to have the fundraising benefit from the YMCA, the annual support campaign. ButlerRadio.com, 724-283-1500. Or online at WISR680.com. We are going to switch gears here in just a couple of minutes, but just something that was really neat that I saw the other day, because it's been cold and, you know, we've had the winter in the past few weeks that we've had. So I was watching a clip, I believe it was on Facebook, but it was one of our Pittsburgh television stations. And they were out at Seven Springs, Hidden Valley, one of the ski resorts. And they were there for whatever job they were doing. But the guy was talking about weather. And he was talking about how you can have a bottled water or a bottle of water in these ice cold temperatures and it not freeze on you. So what he did is he had the camera kind of pan down to the two bottles of water that were on this chair. And it was outside. If it was teens, I wouldn't be surprised. Maybe it was in the 20s. So the water in the bottle should have frozen, if you're under my understanding, right? So I'm watching him, and he says, now this is the trick to this. Now, I don't know how he got the bottle of water outside in this condition. Let me just tell you what happened, because I don't know exactly how he did it. But so there are two bottles of water, and they're, in a sense, with the cap on, upside down, sitting in the chair. They're still liquid, and yet they're outside. They should have been frozen. He says, what happens is you will see this bottle of water instantly turn to ice, but the reason why it's not now is because there's nothing for the ice to grab a hold of, as in like open air. I'm not the scientist. But what he did is then he grabbed one of the bottles on camera, and he said, are you ready? So he turns it over. It still doesn't freeze immediately. He starts to like flick the bottle like with his fingers, and he's just flicking, flicking, flicking. Somehow that created a bubble in the water bottle, and you saw an instant freeze. It was super cool. It was great. But you saw the bottle instantly on the interior freeze up, and it just went straight down that bottle within seconds. And that entire bottle went just solid ice. It was great. It was neat. I don't know, again, how he didn't get the bubble in the water bottle in the first place, because I would think if it's turned upside down, you'd have a water bottle in it. Anyway, his daughter was the camera guy or camera girl, I should say, right, to be official. But she was the camera girl on this particular, if you want to say, story. Because I know the news people have to post a lot. And so that was just one of the things that he wanted to post. It was really neat. It was really cool. So you can look it up if you want. All right, we got more It's Your Turn coming up here in just a minute. It's Friday. Who doesn't love Friday? So we're going to be talking about National Schools Choice Week. That's coming up in a couple of days, actually next week. So we're going to be previewing that with a representative from that council. We'll talk to him coming up next. And at 1 o'clock, the county commissioners are expected to be in. So we'll take care of all of that. That is coming up. I am Tracy Morgan, in for Dave Malarkey with WISR 680 AM. You can also listen to us online at WISR680.com or on Alexa-powered devices. Tracy Morgan for It's Your Turn.
At Butler Health System, there's more to medicine than the most advanced tools and techniques. There's the dedication to providing the most personal care, one that's shared by every member of our team, like renowned neurosurgeon Dr. Michael Horowitz.
I came to Butler because I wanted to practice medicine the way it's supposed to be done. It's truly about the patient. We get to know the people and what's important to them.
That dedication is why Butler Health System is trusted by our neighbors across the region and chosen by exceptional doctors who share our philosophy that the patient comes first, like orthopedic surgeon Charles Spingola.
I knew I'd have the tools and technology, but I also knew that there was a real commitment to genuine care. We don't treat medicine like an assembly line.
At Butler, we know what it takes to provide the very best of care. But more importantly, we know why we have to. Caring hands, remarkable minds. That's Butler Health System.
Shipping things yourself can be extremely complex. You buy the box, you make sure it's secure, and then you got to tape it, then lug it into the car, to the post office. Ugh. Make life easier. Take it to Go and Postal. In between Villa Grande and Kings on Newcastle Road, Go and Postal takes care of all of that for you. And hey, they've got Valentine's Day cards as well, local honey, and lottery tickets. It's just a downright good place to go. Go and Postal, 140 Shockey Lane in Butler, if you got to plug it into the GPS, your friendly neighborhood shipping store.
I'm Tracy Morgan with It's Your Turn, in for Dave Malarkey. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. So coming up here in just a couple of days is something called National School Choice Week. And this is happening January 21st through the 27th. I'll repeat that here in just a moment. But to talk about this and how parents can find the right school fit for their child is Mr. Andrew Campanella, and he's the president of the National School Choice Week and a nationally recognized expert on parental choice in education. Mr. Campanella has served as president of the National School Choice Week since 2012, and he's been an enthusiastic advocate for educational opportunity. Mr. Campanella has led National School Choice Week during the time of remarkable growth. We'll talk about that here in a moment. Before joining that team, he worked in a senior level position, more than one, at two national nonprofit organizations focused on K-12 education, helping enroll students in school choice programs and recruiting new teachers for public schools. Mr. Campanella, thank you very much for joining us.
This has been something that's been going on for quite some time. I know you've been a big part of the growth because you've gone from 150 events in 2011 to 32,000 that are planned for this year. That's a big increase. What's your response to the growth that you've had?
I'm incredibly inspired by it. And really, the credit for this growth has absolutely nothing to do with me and everything to do with students, parents, teachers, community leaders, homeschooling groups at schools across the country, and schools across the country. The growth of school choice in America today is reflected in the fact that there are more parents actively choosing the best education environments for their kids than it ever before. And people are excited about that. They want to let other families know about it. And that has caused School Choice Week to grow so much.
So, Mr. Campanella, first of all, can you explain what is school choice? We've heard the term thrown around now for quite some time, but for those people who don't really participate in it, I don't know if we know enough about it.
I appreciate that question so much. That is such a good question because there is confusion. And what school choice means is empowering parents to choose the best education options that meet the needs of their individual kids. So when we're talking about school choice, we're talking about all of the options. Traditional public schools, public charter schools, public magnet schools, private schools, online academies, and homeschooling. And the goal of National School Choice Week is to let parents know that they have these choices when it comes to their children's education. There are so many different types of schools, as we just talked about, and also so many different programs out there now that parents can use to access the best education for their kids. We just want more people to know about them.
When parents do make their choice of whatever they want their children to go through, do some parents, or is this an option that you can do both? Like, can you go to school and then take some online courses, or is that not done?
Oh, that is a good question. Yes. What we're seeing now is states, school districts, and even private schools, charter schools, homeschooling groups integrate digital online education with the bricks and mortar education that students are getting. So some states have what's called course access. It allows you to go to school for a physical school for a few classes, take other classes online at home or on a computer at your bricks and mortar school. This allows students to tap into some of the best teachers in the world, regardless of where they are in the world. It also allows students to talk with other students online in different states. So what we're doing through technology is connecting students with things that we might not be able to pay for to be taught in each individual school because there might not be interest from enough students in that school for a class to be taught. I think that's exciting because today's students are more plugged in technologically than anybody has ever been in the history of the world. I mean, you put an iPad in the hands of a three-year-old, and it seems like instinctively they know what to do with it. We've got to harness that knowledge of technology to generate more learning. And I think when we do, we're going to see a whole nother academic revolution in this country in terms of more knowledge being accumulated more quickly.
I'd have to say my kids teach me half the time whenever I get something new. My kids know what to do with it, and I don't as an adult. So that is something exciting that we're seeing. But let me ask you about the opponents who say that this is too controversial, that school choice actually hurts public schools. What is your response to that?
No, I think it's a great question. I do hear some folks say that, but I think it's a bit of an old-fashioned or an outdated argument. And here's why I say that. Because when we talk about school choice, we're talking about all these different options. And traditional public schools, public charter schools, magnet schools, online schools, all those options I just mentioned, they are all public schools. So when you have all of those choices, many in the public sector, they're all working hard to compete, to do the best job they can for kids. That doesn't hurt anybody in the public sector. That only lifts up public sector education.
So if National Schools Choice Week is coming up January 21st through the 27th, what are we going to expect nationally? What can we expect in Pennsylvania for this particular week?
What we can expect is open houses, parent nights, information sessions, school fairs. We can expect unprecedented awareness about educational options and educational opportunity. And what we want families in Pennsylvania and across the country to know, again, is they have choices. Nearly 1,000 events across Pennsylvania during School Choice Week. Go to one of them or research your options online at schoolchoiceweek.com.
So let me ask you about Washington for a moment. Is there anything Washington lawmakers are doing to actually expand school choice for children? Is this a state issue? Is this a Washington, D.C., a national issue? Where does this fall?
Well, actually, school choice is really a state issue, and Pennsylvania was one of the national pioneers when it came to expanding access to great school choice options for children and families. That started about two or three decades ago, and it continues up to the current day. So what the federal government can do is remove any barriers that might exist to states expanding more opportunities and greater access to good schools for parents. The other thing that they have done recently is they've made it easier for parents who might want to choose private schools to save money in tax-preferred 529 plans for their kids. So you used to be able to use 529 accounts, which are savings accounts, just for college. Now you can use them for K-12 tuition.
Do you think finances play a big role in parents making the decision for or against whether they stay in public schools where the funds aren't as high? Obviously, you might have to pay for activities or extracurricular items. But in this choice, it seems like there seems to be more money coming out of my pocket as a parent.
That's a really good question. Let me just put it this way. So when you have the public sector choices, traditional public schools, public charter schools, magnet schools, online academies, those are all public choices. And so those choices are free to attend because you're paying taxes and your tax dollars are going to support public education. So like you said, you might have to pay for some activities, but you're not paying tuition. In Pennsylvania, if you want to go to a private school, send your child to a private school, there's something called the Educational Improvement Tax Credit Program that provides tuition assistance for families who may not make enough money to afford tuition. So it's called EITC, Educational Improvement Tax Credit. There's also an opportunity scholarship program that helps provide tuition assistance for families, too. So private schools, they do charge tuition. That is correct. But there are ways to make that tuition more affordable.
How do we find out more information, one, about the National School Choice Week, which, again, coming up January 21st to the 27th, and then how do we find out about our choices within the state of Pennsylvania in our area, the Pittsburgh-Butler area?
Great question. The best way to find out more information about School Choice Week and the options that you have is to go to schoolchoiceweek.com and write that down. That's schoolchoiceweek.com. We have an entire guide to school choice in Pennsylvania that parents can download. It's one page. It's super helpful. We also have a map on our website where you can type in your zip code, find events, activities, and participants near you.
Mr. Andrew Campanella, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you once again. It was my pleasure. Always good to have you on. One thing I wanted to mention before we go today, I was reading this earlier in the week, and it's just something that it hits home for me just because I've been able to go to the hospital. It's St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, and they have just released information that a new type of gene therapy that was pioneered, if you will, at St. Jude's appears to be building fully functional immune systems in babies born with what they call bubble boy disease. And if you remember, we heard about this well, it's still around, but we heard a lot about it in years past where there's no immune system in the child. So they're, in a sense, living in a bubble. And so with this particular finding, they say that the gene therapy is working very well. And in some trials that they had, they said their patients that were enrolled in their trials, most of these patients ended up having an immune system for the very first time. I just think that's worth mentioning. It's just something that you just want to applaud. And see, if you haven't been to St. Jude's Research Hospital, what they do is they're a hospital that takes care of kids primarily with cancer, but yet they do branch out into these other realms like brittle bone disease, this particular immune system challenge for kids. So they do great work, and I was able to visit there, a handful of years ago now, and actually I was fortunate enough to go twice. And it was just something whenever you see these kids who can tell you about cancer and tell you all the technical terminology that even as adults we sometimes have a hard time grasping. So it's just wonderful whenever I hear something about St. Jude's that I just kind of, smile. You guys just kind of sit back for a moment and think, wow, the universe and the world is bigger than me. And this is something that's a good piece of news. So I'm glad that they're able to do that. And I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that as that news continues, but worth mentioning. We will continue the program in just a couple of minutes. Again, the county commissioner is expected to be in here at 1 o'clock, and we'll go with that and talk to them right after this. I'm Tracy Morgan, in for Dave Mullarkey, and this is It's Your Turn.
For so many of us, a loving pet is, well, it's a member of the family, isn't it? If you're looking for a veterinarian you can trust when it comes time for a checkup or treatment for a pet that's ill, consider Suburban Animal Clinic and Dr. Dennis Damon, Route 8 south of Butler, 4 miles south of Butler, right at the intersection of Route 8 South and Thorncrest Drive. Dr. Damon treats small animals, dogs, cats, all small animals, and exotic pets, too. If you have a question about illness, symptoms, shots, a checkup, if you need to talk to someone about concerns with an aging pet or a pet near the end of life, you can trust Dr. Dennis Damon. He loves animals. He's a pet owner himself. Dr. Dennis Damon, veterinarian at Suburban Animal Clinic. Hours by appointment only, Monday through Saturday. Credit cards are accepted, and he makes house calls, too. Dr. Dennis Damon, Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, 4 miles south of Butler at the intersection of Route 8 and Thorncrest Drive. Phone 287-5289.
You're a dog owner, a dog parent. What does your dog mean to you? Company? Fun? Affection? Sure. But let's add comfort. Your dog offers a level of comfort at just the right time when you need some of that. Comfort. And that's what O'Shea offers at Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler. Comfort. So many people have told us that with O'Shea present at a funeral, she offers a level of comfort that's indescribable. Comfort for the family and comfort for everyone attending. So O'Shea is available for a funeral service, but only if requested by the family. O'Shea creates a feeling of calm, comfort. So come in and meet O'Shea and see why so many folks want her here at a funeral. And while you're here, ask about our unique services, our competitive costs, and our cremation program. Call us at 724-287-3706, 287-3706, or visit our website at www.thompson-miller.com. Thompson Miller Funeral Home, the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Welcome back to the program. Tyler Frio in for Dave Mullarkey. It's your turn on WISR 680 AM. And we have the privilege here and the honor to talk with the Butler County Commissioners as they essentially are midway through their first term as County Commissioners. And Kevin Boozle joins us, Leslie Oshie, Kim Geyer, you guys are all here. Can you believe it? Midway through your first term?
Pretty amazing.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's amazing it went by so fast.
Yeah, it did go by fast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, well, I do want to start with that then. Obviously, all three of you had maybe a different goal coming in mind, you know, after your election. And so we'll start there. And Kevin, I'll start with you. Do you feel so far that the goals you set out to accomplish that you have been able to do that?
I do. I think that there's, while you have goals and you have your own mindset of where you want to go, I think that you just run into so many other I used to joke with my friends. I said, I'm like a cat with a new toy every day, right? So there's something new that falls on your desk every single day. So you get to do that, but you also get to do what your agenda items are. So it takes a little longer to get things done, I think, than maybe you had anticipated coming into office. But I think that as long as you keep those goals in mind and keep working towards them, as we all have, I think that we have accomplished a lot along the way over these past 2 years.
Leslie, I'll turn to you. Your thoughts?
Yeah, you know what? It's been really a busy 2 years, and we came in, I think, everybody with a little bit different things. But it took it wasn't long before we really realized we were on the same page and had the same objectives and things that we wanted to accomplish, and we were able to quickly kind of put those into perspective. And you know, the most important thing I think for me is always to be able to look back and take the temperature and say, are we getting there? You know, was that what we set out to do? Are we getting there? Because it's easy to get lost in that day-to-day stuff and not look back and say, are we actually accomplishing what we said we were going to accomplish? So I feel confident that we are on that path. I mean, we still have a lot to do, but we definitely, it's been amazing what's been done, I think, in 2 years.
And Kim, I'll turn to you. Your thoughts?
Pretty much the same. It's really been an amazing 2 years that we've been able to do government and be commissioners in a different way in comparison to probably our predecessors, and trying to change the way government is here in Butler County for the benefit of the people that live and work here. So when we start to list things that goals that we've been able to accomplish mm-hmm. and things that we have worked on in the past 2 years, it's amazing to even ourselves how great that list is.
We sat down one day and did that, and we had like two or three pages. I mean, we just kept going.
Yeah, you forget it because you're so mm-hmm. entwined in the mm-hmm. the moment mm-hmm. of trying to achieve those goals and objectives. And it's, I think, one of the greatest accomplishments that we've been able to achieve here in the county is the ability to work together and collaborate.
And I think, and I'll go there, and we're going to dive into some of these issues in particular in just a moment, but we talk about working together. That seems to be, and I think in this past election, that was something that voters of Butler County were looking for
Absolutely.
A board that was cordial, if you will.
Right.
And you had mentioned, too, Kevin, about roadblocks and everything, you know, coming. Every day you come into work, it could be something different.
Right.
How have you learned to adapt? And essentially, and I think a lot of elected officers say this, is that there's really no experience you can – I mean, there's experience you can drive upon, but that job is a little bit different. So right. what do you – how do you adapt, and what do you draw on to make those decisions?
Well, I think that just having an open, transparent communication is extremely important. So we may have differing opinions, or we may even differ on how to get to the end goal, but we usually will land at somewhere around the same goal. And so that's extremely important for us to be able to move it forward and take these problems as they come and work them into an opportunity, hopefully, that works for the majority. And we've been able to do that. I think we've taken on some pretty lofty tasks over the last 2 years. Some were very public and some things mm-hmm. that were happening in our community, but others are just day-to-day activities that happen. But if you get bogged down into your own agenda too far, you could easily lose track of what the common goal is. And not that we always agree, because we certainly do not, but we've come to an area where we're comfortable, we trust each other, and we get to a relationship where, okay, we may disagree, but we're going to agree to disagree, and we're going to keep this ball moving. We're not going to allow this ball to stop or drop.
It's like being married.
Yes. Well, yeah, a lot of like, I mean, there's a lot of compromises that have to happen on a daily basis, you mm-hmm. know. And I'm blessed to work with the two fine commissioners that we have, along with myself, and I really find that you know, anything from housing to nonprofits to for-profits, economic development, you can't. And the boards that we appoint can be trying at times, because maybe we didn't pay as much attention to them as we should have. But you have so much time in a day, and you try to work with each one as you move forward. And you know, but I think that we've been able to move the ball and continuously not only move the ball, but keep track of the things that we've been working on so that they don't fall through the cracks at the same time.
Somewhat on the same note, Leslie, things that have surprised you. And that could be day-to-day things, but more broadly, the role itself, you know, when you were elected, things that you didn't expect you would have to deal with that you have to deal with now. What would they be?
Well, and I laugh, because I think, you know, if you asked me that last year, I'd say one thing. If you asked me that this year, I'd say mm-hmm. something else. And, you know, I feel like the work itself didn't change that much. I moved into a different chair in a different building in a different office, but we've always done community-based work. So that part of it, the relationships, you know, new people, different things. Honestly, I think it's in part it's the politics that maybe none of us were used to, and getting over those hurdles. I think there's still, you know, there's still some gender bias that I didn't really think was as tough as it was going to be. Not so much locally, but more, we find that more regionally and at, you know, state level when you start to operate. So that, you know, I hate to even admit that, but it really has been something we've run into. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, but mm-hmm. I think the politics of of and the maneuvering within that has been a challenge for us a little bit.
And Kim, you saw the commissioner's role a little bit more closely than Leslie and Kevin. Mm-hmm. When you officially became a commissioner, anything that was different that you didn't see coming your way?
There hasn't been too many surprises, but at the same time, alluding to what Leslie had just mentioned, the politics of it at the regional and statewide level has been really interesting in regards to many of the boards that we serve on and projects that we work on are male-dominated, and that's the world we live in. And it's interesting working with different personalities and understanding motives of people and trying to understand when you're trying to advance an issue forward, why you're getting pushback, and you have to question things and that. But that's not to say that there isn't another solution and
right.
another way of working.
Find another way around.
Mm-hmm. Working around it, not circumventing it, but overcoming that challenge to do what is really, truly right. Mm-hmm. And in what you're trying to achieve.
And you mentioned challenges outside of the county, and you guys go, you know, work with a lot of county commissioners around the state, and that's where I wanted to talk, at least looking forward. Are there certain initiatives or certain issues that you have found with other county commissioners, you know, when you get together, that they are finding in their own areas around the state? And Kevin, we'll start with you.
Yes. it is interesting, and it's really nice. Armstrong County is similar to Butler County, mm-hmm. obviously, and they have three new commissioners as well. We also sit on the Workforce Investment Board, and they're seeing a lot of the same struggles that we see with economic growth, and part of that is training up and having the employment availability and also having the trained employees to take those positions. And are we really doing what we need to be doing as county commissioners to make sure that that's progressing to where we feel it should be going? And so we've been spending some time on that. But I would also say, you know, statewide and national issues, which such as the opioid issues, we're running into very similar situations that we can bounce some ideas off of each other, kind of learn from each other, bring back what we've learned. And that's one of the reasons why the state conferences are so important, because those really give you an opportunity. There's not too many people that do what we do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we can talk to each other, but we already know what our issue is. We may not know a solution out there. So it is nice to have that conversation at a statewide level, even a national level. But, you know, we are blessed with Butler County having so many great employees in it and so many of the row officers, directors. People are taking – one of the things I'm most proud of is that we've enabled people to take on stronger roles of leadership throughout the county, and they've done a great job at doing that. But that doesn't happen by accident. It's a cultural shift. You know, some people were used to coming and asking for everything, and we're kind of turning it over and saying, you know, where do you want to go? Where do you see – what are your priorities in your agency or your department? And so we support – we are a big support system for them as well, but equally for other county commissioners.
Leslie, I want to turn to the state. The budget process there is always in turmoil. How does that affect – when you guys are looking at finances, when you're looking at numbers, what's your process in dealing with the state?
Well, you know, when we came into office, obviously we came in at a time when there was a budget impasse yet once again, and they had not resolved the budget. And, you know, it affects our financial situation, because at that time we had to make a decision about how much of a tax anticipation note we were going to take in order to keep cash flow moving. So it affects cash flow tremendously, and when there's not a budget resolution. So I think our focus with CCAT, with the County Commissioners Association, really has been, you know, trying to get them and encouraging them to pass a budget and pass it on time. I mean, that's a number one. And the second is, if there is any sort of disagreement and that extension goes on, you have the demand was to keep the cash flowing, because the biggest portion of the budget is human services. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest piece that comes from the state, obviously. And if we were to have to front that money continually, one, you can't keep agencies afloat. You can't fund that much cash flow at one time. So we were successful, I think, in making sure, you know, together collaboratively with CCAP, that the money would keep flowing even in the event of an impasse, and we're guaranteed that that would occur, especially the federal pass-through funds. So that was, I think, one of the biggest issues. And then really just helping, I think, our legislators understand what are the priorities and what are the things that mean the most to the county. And you know, we're not always battling for more money for things that, you know, we're not going to go out there and argue for dollars for things that we don't think should be spent, and dollars that should mm-hmm. be spent, because I think we want the state to be as efficient as the county is. So I think, you know, that's been understanding that process and watching how it occurs and how oftentimes they tie a lot of other things to bills mm-hmm. and budgets and that have absolutely nothing to do with the budget. And that's the politics. That's where the politics gets interesting.
And mm-hmm. Kim, I'll go to you on this one. How do you manage those different relationships? You know, you have to work with the state, you have to work with other county commissioners, and of mm-hmm. course you have to work with your constituents at home. How do you balance where our focus needs to be?
I think it's about finding that common denominator with the people that you network with the mm-hmm. people that you work with, and helping them to understand what it is that you're advocating for. And for us as leaders, being consistent with what our goals are, what we discuss at the county level in our office on a daily basis, and what we're seeing and experiencing, and what the people that live and work in Butler County are experiencing, and then communicating that in a efficient, you know, manner mm-hmm. to those people, so that we're on the same page. And when I come back from a meeting at the state or in D.C., we sit down and we talk about what mm-hmm. we communicated mm-hmm. and why. And then we have a discussion about that. So then if Kevin leaves the office and goes to a meeting, he's advocating the same mm-hmm. line as it pertains to transportation or a various issue.
You mentioned different issues. We're going to dive into those next. We're going to get a little bit more specific about what's going on in Butler County. I'm Tyler Friel, in for Dave Malarkey. We've got the three county commissioners here, and you're listening to It's Your Turn on WISR 680 AM.
Since 1938, Hunter Truck Sales has been a leader in the trucking industry. With 19 locations, we've grown to be the largest heavy truck dealership network in the Northeast. Proudly, Hunter has employed generations of families in the region and was recently honored to be named 2017 Family Business of the Year by the Pittsburgh Business Times. Check it out online at huntertrucksales.com for truck inventory, careers, and locations. Across our network, Hunter will provide solutions for all your trucking needs.
Welcome back to It's Your Turn, listeners. Tyler Friel in for Dave Malarkey. Cold temperatures are here. Maybe not this weekend, but we're not done with the winter. And that's why we want to tell you about our friends at Miller's Shoes in downtown Butler. They have been on Main Street for 120 years. And what I like about Miller's, not only is their shoe selection and the variety that they have, but the fact that you go in, and Jimmy will sit down with you. They'll get the perfect fit for you, your shoe. I took my grandmother there, I think last winter, and they had exactly what she got going back to the 1980s. They keep detailed records about what your shoe order is. You're not going to find that anywhere else. You're not going to find that at the big box stores. So go to Miller Shoes. They have all the name brands, whether you're into Timberlands. They got America's Best SAS. They have everything there that your heart desires, and they will get it fit right for you. Miller Shoes, downtown Butler. Make sure you check them out, and we thank them for sponsoring It's Your Turn. We're talking to the county commissioners of Butler, Kevin Boozle, Leslie Oshie, and Kim Geyer. We're diving into some of the issues that have popped up over the first 2 years. And we're going to start with what I would say most residents in the county deem the number one issue, and that's the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. When you guys, in the summits and seminars have gone on, Kevin, we'll start with you. Is there a plan in place? How do you have these conversations? And, I mean, we know what the end goal is,
sure.
But how do you get to that point? Or at least have those, what are those conversations like?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to own the problem, right? And we did that originally. The county commissioners pulled together the forums and pulled the leadership together. And Leslie directed them into a single room and was able to get everyone talking about the same issue. We may not agree on how to get to the end product, right? Mm-hmm. Again, it's a similar situation. But we have to agree that we are not going to leave the room until we come up with a common goal. And so that was instrumental in the beginning to make sure that that happened. And then moving forward, you got to look at the whole picture. You know, the beauty of being at a county level is you get to talk to a lot of people, from the local municipality to the individual resident. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but then you get to talk to the state leadership and what they're thinking and the federal leadership. But then we also have the objective of looking at the funds that are coming in for this issue. And, you know, I think that it's really easy to get spun up in this where you can't really see a way out. So you have to really almost draw a map and make sure everyone's following the same map. And the biggest part for me is education, making sure people understand that this is an epidemic. This is a crisis. We are at a crisis level. I also think that we didn't get here yesterday. We got here over a long period of time for multiple reasons, and we can point fingers all day. But the reality is we're here, and we own it. And then moving forward, what are we going to do about it? And so part of that was education. Part of that was making sure that there was medical treatment. Part of that was making sure there was funding to provide the inpatient, outpatient care. And also, you know, there's a stigma behind it, obviously. And a lot of parents are feeling that, and they were hiding it in shame. And they weren't seeking services maybe quick enough. But we broke down a lot of those barriers along the way. But the education part doesn't end there. There's also a timeline that I look at, a bell curve. So we got here, the opioid crisis continues to grow. At the very best we can hope for is that we can minimize the growth and bring it back down. But it doesn't end it. There's no magic pill, no magic naloxone, no magic anything that makes it go away. And we can't throw everyone in jail. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't work either. So we've come to a determination that it takes every piece of the puzzle to pull this off. And so that comes down to treatment. It comes down to education. It comes down to acceptance. It comes down to legal, making sure that the dealers are dealt with properly and put in jail. And really just keeping people on a positive curve, right? We can sit and wallow in all the problems, but that's not going to get it done. We, as leaders, have to own it and move it forward. And I think we've done that.
And Leslie, I mean, when you're looking at this problem, and Kevin talked about a roadmap, is that roadmap generally agreed upon by most officials around the state and the county on how to get to an end goal?
I think generally, you know, I think we talked about the state talked about, everyone has talked about the need for collaboration between health, you know, the health field and law enforcement in particular. So health and safety have to come together in order to make a difference here. And our experience in our community has been that with the help of everybody at the table, we can find that map forward. And we are grateful, especially, that our media came mm-hmm. with us on that ride and helped us take a lead in actually organizing those. And we're willing to step out front because of the need to educate and educate the public, and that's so critical to it, and to lead that conversation. We have to continue a conversation. Because we're never going to agree on 100% on how we got here. And it's important to look back, though, and say, how did we get here? Because if you don't ever look back, you know, you have to know from whence you came. Mm-hmm. So you really do need to look backward and say, how did this happen? How did we? Because you have to have an understanding of how to go forward. But you do also have to go forward. I mean, life says you have to go forward. So it's been a learning process for everybody. But the other piece that we have to remember is sometimes you want to draft some big plan, mm-hmm. okay, that you think is going to, you know, we got this big plan and we're going to implement it and, you know, and it's going to solve the problem and we're going to look back and go, yay, you know, we did that. Next thing, you know. There, with something like this, there is no such thing. Mm-hmm. There is no big plan. I think what we have to look at is the small pockets of success in places, and the ability to say, this is not us and them, this is us. We are this, you know, we are, we've met the enemy, it's us. we've met the solution, it's us. And be able to break down, I think, the barriers that prevent us from moving forward. So when we start to look at those pockets of success, we just have to look at this differently than you do other things, because...
And is that the toughest part about it, is that no one can... You know, when you come up with an infrastructure plan, everybody feels these dollars can go here, we can do this, and this is what the end result looks like. With this, there seems to be so much fluidity with it. And as you said, no one knows exactly what the root of the problem is. Everyone has their own opinion. No one knows exactly what the answer is. Everyone has their own opinion. Is that the toughest part, is that it's just so difficult to find how to get to the ultimate goal?
It's such a complex issue that... And it knows no socioeconomic, you know, boundaries or demographics. It's something that's affecting, you know, as Leslie said, us is we, and we are us. It's just been really critical to be able to bring people together here in our county, our leaders, and try to educate people on what resources exist here throughout our county that are able to be helpful to the people that that need them. And so that's been one area that we have worked extensively on and will continue to do so, bringing those resources and education and traveling throughout the county to address those issues.
There's no smooth way to segue, but we do have a lot to hit on. So I want to jump to the new county 911 system. This was a major investment for the county to make. Kevin, how are things going?
They're moving. we see a lot of towers and contracts and a lot of back-end work that people wouldn't notice, really. The only thing that the residents want to know is that it's going to work, and then I'm going to get services at the end of the day, right? But there's so much in the background of that, from the backhaul to make sure there's duplication of service so that it doesn't, you know, fail at any single point. We're going to have a redundancy for a while, carrying over from one system to the other, so that's going to cause a little more stress on both the end user, the firefighter, the police, and EMS, and also on the 911 center. But I think that we've gone into this very wide-eyed, and knowing that there's going to be a cost, a continued cost, we built that in. We knew what it would be. We also, I think, made partners of our municipalities and our fire services and made it very clear that, you know, everyone has a piece of this and everyone has to be vested in it, because we as commissioners are not communication specialists, right? So we listen to the communications council, the police, the fire, the EMS, and the municipalities, and they are vested. They had to pony up some dollars to get the end user radios and things, but what that did for us was it really opened up great lines of communication between us and municipality. And as a firefighter, sometimes the relationships or the communication isn't as good as what you would think it would be between the municipality and the fire service. So it caused some communication lines to open. It also caused some things to fester up that was happening before. But overall, the radio system's been very positive. The funding is on target. I don't think we're out of line in any direction. And we're going to end up with a great system for years to come. And as Steve Weishaus had said, this will probably be the last radio system that they purchase, looking forward into the future with the technology and where it's going. But this should carry us through quite well.
And Leslie, can you take us through why the county had to do this?
Well, I mean, two reasons. The first is that our current system was at its end of life. And the second was, of course, that as part of the ARRA, I guess it would have been the Recovery Act, there, the government, federal government, and the Public Utility Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, made the decision to sell off the T-band, which was the band with that we were currently on, because obviously there's a demand out there for data and for waves for data. So clearly we had to be off that T-band. I think we were ordered by 2023. Sorry, I have to think. We've been the somebody. 2021. We've been we needed to be off in 2021. Yeah. Yeah, we needed to be off the T band by 2021, so that they could actually take those out and put them up, put those the T band up for bid. So we don't know. I mean, I think the system being at end of life, we were going to have to purchase that system anyway. It really kind of pushed that up along, and it also changed the conversation about the nature of the system we were going to in the future. Now, the good part about all of that is that there were a lot of counties around us in the region and the state. Everyone's implementing something new at the same time, and I think the idea was that, you know, there would be we want to make sure that there's backup. So therefore, every county should be able to communicate with every other county in any emergency or communication. So it was an opportunity for us to also share a core, which is located in Westmoreland County, with this region, and take advantage of the savings in that manner, and at the same time have that interoperable services available to us for. So if we go down here, you know, our guys can pick up and go over to Lawrence County and be in a seat and take calls in Lawrence County, just the same as they would. And likewise, if something happens in Lawrence County, they can take calls in Butler County.
So this wasn't a decision. This was almost a decision where your hands were forced because things were going to expire.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And sort of on the same, at least in terms of emergency responders, Kim, this has been a weird 2 years in terms of just natural weather incidents. We've been a part of it right here with flooding on the West End.
Right.
How has it been? What's your role in terms of these natural, we'll call them natural disasters, for lack of a better phrase? And what's your thoughts on how the emergency responders have dealt with this?
Well, the county communicates to 911, to Steve Beishaus Emergency Services. And Steve and Rob McFlafferty are really instrumental in providing updates to us on a regular basis when there's flooding occurring or an emergency occurring throughout the county. And they pretty much handle everything with our response team, the appropriate teams, whether it's water rescue or hazmat, and are very instrumental in updating us and apprising us of any developments, good or bad. And that's our role, is to support them and to provide them the tools, the resources, and the funding they need to be able to do the job it is that they do. Our teams have been, I want to say, exceptional in the past several weeks. Specifically, we've had flooding and a blizzard in the same week. You know, from temperatures warming up and then freezing to frigid below zero. So the teams of people that are out there dedicating their lives and putting their lives on the line, first responders, have done an extraordinary job for our residents.
I want to switch the conversation to economics, and this is I find it almost hard to believe that it all happens in the same county. You've had the expansion of the Southwest Corridor. We're talking the Cranberry Mars area. Right. It is blossoming. And then you look at the northern part, and it's not keeping pace. Over the next 2 years, or for however long you're in office, what's the goal? How do you want the county to look? Because you've had this great economic expansion in the southern part, and it's a little bit behind pace in the northern part. Kevin, we'll start with you.
Well, being from the north, I can tell you that there's a lot of people that are very satisfied with where they're at, and so you have to respect that. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we've done is gone out to each of the municipalities and really listened to what they want to see happen. Equally, then we come back and say, okay, this is a, as Leslie's statement would be, a corridor, and this is where we're going to develop. You got to keep in mind, we're not just looking at development. We got to think about the agricultural community. We got to think about the tourism piece of it, and we got to think about the commercialized and the light industry and so on. So we're looking at it from a macro view as opposed to a micro view. But we have to make sure that we're in it with them, right? We have to be able to cover both sides. And so, you know, I think that it's really nice that we can offer support and offer them, you know, from the state level, some funding if we can go grab some grants, you know, low volume road grants or whatever. But we really have to listen to the local municipality. That's what's driving us. Mm-hmm. And so we have to take that and put it into a larger plan for the whole county and make sure that we're not treading on anyone else's water. But at the same time, we've got to make sure we're carrying the water back from the state and federal government to make sure that our services are being delivered here in Butler. And that's a struggle. That's a difficult portion of – we have to go battle sometimes.
And when you talk to these municipalities, what's their conversations? Are they satisfied with where they are? Would they like to see a little bit more coming their way? How do the people in the north – How do the people of the north feel?
My people. It's interesting because as we go out and talk to the communities, they get excited about some of the things that are happening. We share what's happening, and I'll give you a perfect example. In Harrisville, a very quiet community, mm-hmm. pretty docile, not a bit large growth, right? But they are hearing what's happening in Saxonburg, and Saxonburg is being one of those walkable, livable areas that's kind of promoted, and tourism's going there, and Mingo on Main, and the mm-hmm. whole thing. Well, they're hearing about that. So one of the things that I was able to do is get the council of Harrisville to come down to Saxonburg and sit down with them and find out, how do they do this? What money did they go after? Was it worth it? How did your residents respond whenever you wanted to do this type of development along Main Street? And some of it was good and some of it was bad, but regardless, now those two communities are in constant contact with what they're doing, and actually the two mayors are actually planning a dinner so that they can share some of their ideas again and come back every so often. I think that, just making connections, being able to express what's happening in the South and North, they have to move at their own pace. We're not going to drive them. Mm-hmm. And if we do, then we're going to drive them away, and we don't want to do that either. So I think that overall, the satisfaction, if a community wants the service, if somebody wants to develop, somebody wants to do some economic growth or whatever it is they want, we're open, and we've always had an open door. And now we are realigning some of our services within the county to provide better services for them. So it's all about customer service from the municipalities to the resident, and even having the state involved with what we're trying to do. We're not out here in an island, mm-hmm. right? We have to let them know, here's where we're going. This is why we're going here. And again, we're drawing a map around what we want to see happen and not what we want to see, what the community wants to see happen.
Mm-hmm. And Leslie, I want to turn to you because when we have, at least when I have conversations with Nick Newpower and some of these colleges, high schools, right. universities, right. whatever they may be, one thing that they always point out is declining enrollment in the high schools.
Mm-hmm.
How do you attract people to the Butler County area? Essentially, there's not enough people living here in the future. You've got small mm-hmm. kindergarten classes right. at the Butler Area School District, which right. is something that hasn't happened. How do you bring people in?
Well, Let me start with how we got where we're at right now first. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the community college. The community college, community development corporation, chamber of commerce, all of those organizations that have been involved in economic development in the county over the years have done two separate studies on economic development and how to help. And let's also realize that it really is business that's going to drive that. It's our businesses, mm-hmm. and that's who we're representing in this mm-hmm. instance. What came out of both of those studies in 2009 and 2014 is that we needed to do a better job of collaborating and having a more unified effort around economic development in order to drive it further north, I guess you could say. They're doing a fantastic job, as we said, in the southern part of the county in growing and making the moves that they need to make in order to attract more business. And let's face it, you know, all the governments have done a great job, all the municipalities, in keeping the taxes at a mm-hmm. that in a place that makes it very attractive for business and mm-hmm. and residents to move here. But after those two plans were done, they were shelved, and we had to dust them off, bring them back out, and say, look, if this is going to go forward, we got to make this happen. And we recognized that we needed a leader in that realm, and someone that was independent of all of those organizations. And they were asking for the county to take the lead in the past, and it didn't happen. So we did, and we put in place the chief of economic development, who was now Mark Gordon, who was former plant manager or general manager of AK Steel, who has been working to pull those entities together. But what has happened because of that? I think because of that increased communication, and as we're moving forward mm-hmm. because of the outreach to municipalities, because he was charged with internally aligning our departments to be supportive to the municipalities and externally aligning the organizations to be supportive to the businesses that either wanted to expand or move here. So
we're really at a great place now, because what you're hearing is the lots are sold at, the lots are pretty close to being all sold at Pullman. They're almost sold at Victory Road, you know, the business parks that CDC had in place. There is good news about what is coming here. There's an interest in the city of Butler. But the transportation is also key to that, and we can talk about that. But I think when you talk about attracting and keeping young families here, there are quality of life issues that we have to address in order to make sure that there is, you know, housing that is acceptable and affordable, that there is public transit, there are sidewalks, there are bike lanes, there is recreation. All of those things are quality of life to attract families here, and the education has to be quality. So the school districts and the municipalities and the county, we have to work together in ways that we never did before. It would be unusual. And what you see now is the new superintendent, Brian White, has been fantastic about reaching out to the local municipalities, and likewise the other way. And as that, we start to get on the page about, you know, how that happens, you're going to see more people want to come here and stay here. And as the businesses are moving, the jobs are going to be here for them.
Are there certain industries that stick out that Butler, you would say, does really well in, or is it a wide variety?
Well, we still remain a strong manufacturing community, which not many people can say. I mean, our county is still very strong in manufacturing, but the growth in energy has been out, you know, amazing too. And to have a hub of natural gas and nuclear at the same time, you know, just down the road. I mean, it's, you know, unusual. We just need one good coal mine and we'd be great. You know? but we got it all. We're self-sufficient, right? But I think it's, you know, it's remarkable that we still remain that strong in the manufacturing sector.
And you mentioned the chief economic officer. Kim, I'm going to turn to you, because we've gotten on open talk portions of the show, people were going, why the heck is this guy getting a salary? What does that job entail? What does that job entail?
Well, it entails, Mark is amazing. He brings a breadth of experience and knowledge base that's unique, because he's not from the government sector. He's from the, you know, the private sector, has come in and is looking at things and doing things in a different, totally different manner. He meets with people through from various businesses, talks to them, and creates working relationships with them in regards to advocating, telling them, you know, how they could fit into Butler County and why and where and how it makes sense, and tries to help provide the resources to them to enable them to succeed once they're here. So
I think we have to give, I think we can give a couple really clear examples here of why that was needed. Let's talk first about InSpec. You know, the closing of that plant for the northern part of our county was devastating. And, you know, all politicians rush in and we all want to help, and we're all trying to figure out how we can help. But the only person that could get that door opened really to have a discussion with the owners about transitioning that plant for another purpose, or being able to save parts of that plant so that it could be repurposed for another use and another plant and more jobs in the future, was him, because he came from manufacturing, and there you have a trust level there that you can call up another manufacturer.
Absolutely.
And there's a relationship already built that he was able to get in and meet with the plant folks and, you know, talk about what does that future look like for that property. And then also at the same time has his ear to the ground on what else is out there that could move into that plant and has incredible potential on all over the place. I mean, things that we can't unfortunately yet talk about, but because of those relationships. Other companies are wanting to move in and need rail access. And so therefore, because of his relationship with the railroads, is able to contact them and able to negotiate and navigate so that they can get the rail access and the sidings that they're going to need in order to build their plants here and come here. So especially with the Shell cracker plant development in Beaver County, you know, one of us couldn't have, we can't negotiate those things. Those are not relationships that we have. So I think, you know, if we did anything smart, that was probably it.
it was a great,
you know, and I don't mean it that way, but I think it's the return on that investment we will see for years to come.
And that took us a while to get there. We went down a few roads before we got there. It took us longer than we anticipated or wanted to really take to get Mark in. But it was a good choice to wait and get the right person. We didn't fill the planning director position on purpose. We knew we wanted to reorganize and rethink it, and we did that.
And don't forget,
he's been so busy since he arrived because, I mean, as he's trying to get entrenched into what we're working on, business is coming in and in and trying to get established here in the county, and he's working on that while he's working on other things. He's been incredible.
There's one more vote that I want to bring up. This happened last May, and we talk economics and infrastructure, and they all blend together. It was the vehicle tax. It was an offer from the state, essentially a $5 vehicle tax for every registration, which is now 2 years. All three of you voted no. And, Kim, I'm going to start with you on this because you, at that meeting, flushed it out with about five pages worth of flip sheets. I want to – can you take me through why you voted no? Because you seem very impassioned about this particular subject.
Well, it was – I really did not want to vote no. I think that was my paradox at that time. It was the first time I really didn't feel I voted my conscience, and it really upset me. I was really upset with it because all the data and research that I was able to present at that meeting provided a reason as to why we should implement a $5 vehicle registration fee. And due to the lack of funding that we receive in transportation funding, I know Pennsylvania is the highest in gasoline tax, 70 cents more so than other states. And our residents are paying that, but what they don't realize is we're not getting a return on our investment. We're getting less than 3% of funding, statewide funding for transportation to fix our roads and bridges. And that's so this was a way why we had to consider it was the $5 fee was, and again, the registration fee has been broken down. It's now good for 2 years, so it would be like $2.50 per year. We need to invest in our roads and our bridges, and this was a way that we would be able to do that, generate $2 million, and then the state would match that with an additional $2 million, which would give, and those monies would stay here in Butler County exclusively, and we'd have $4 million to start working with to address our roads and bridges. And so that's why I was so passionate about it. Mm-hmm. And why I voted no was because I was hearing from people and entities throughout the county that were saying, no, don't raise my taxes. They looked at it as a tax increase, and the result is pushback. But I had questioned some of the people that had contacted me via email were questionable whether they were truly people, true human beings, because I was getting some fictitious names and things that led me to believe that there was another motive here. So it's something that we have been actively pursuing and trying to create other solutions to address it other than doing the $5 vehicle registration fee. But what we need to have our residents realize is we receive 3% of funding for transportation was given to the counties throughout that did not vote for Act 89 in 2013. And we are one of those counties. Our legislators did not vote to support Act 89 because of the 70 cents fee for gasoline tax. And so we receive less than that 3%. We don't even receive 3%. We receive less than that 3%. And that's what most people in Butler County don't realize. They're driving down roads in 228 and are wondering, why aren't these roads fixed? Mm-hmm. And that's truly the reason why.
We've got, real quick, before we go to break, any of you have a thought on it?
I think that maybe the timing. The timing, okay. The timing for that, I don't know that the compelling case was there yet. There's a lot happening right now. And
is an offer like that still on the table?
The offer, I think, is still on the table. Okay. But from the state?
Yes, from the state.
The offer is still on the table.
Okay. All right. We'll take a short break. We'll come back, and we'll continue on. We're a little bit behind. So
all right.
Sorry.
We'll
catch up.
Lottery breaks.
Catch up.
You're listening to It's Your Turn on WISR 680 AM.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick two is 56, 5-6. The pick three is 570. The pick four, 9944. The pick five, 18428. The wild ball is 2. The treasure hunt, 2, 3, 4, 8, and 16. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000.
Whether you're a competitive athlete or a weekend warrior, any injury that keeps you on the sidelines should be treated by a sports medicine expert. Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers offers sports medicine specialists right here in Butler to get you back to enjoying the activities you love. Doctors Rob Waltrip, Josh Szabo, and John Richmond have trained with some of the biggest names in orthopedic sports medicine and use their expertise to treat you. Tri-Rivers accepts most major insurance plans, including both Highmark and UPMC. Learn more at TriRiversMSK.com. Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, partnering with the Butler community for more than 20 years.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location downtown Butler to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Welcome back to It's Your Turn, listeners. I'm Tyler Friel, filling in for Dave Malarkey, and we are talking with the Butler County Commissioners, Kevin Boozel, Leslie Oshie, and Kim Geyer. We left on the topic of conversation about transit and infrastructure, different things like that. So, Kevin, I'll turn to you. The bus going to Pittsburgh, how has that gone?
Well, that was kind of thrust upon us, I think. Okay. You know, we started working with the Butler Transit Authority and trying to help them make it more of a county resource as opposed to a city and township. And so we've been working on that process. But I think that the delivery of service to Pittsburgh is new, and I think that we were thrust into taking over a route that was well established for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And some of the ridership was not willing to really consider changes, and so it was difficult. It's, you know, some of these riders, we took the ride on the bus, and some of them rode 20 years on the same bus, which is pretty amazing. You know, different bus companies throughout the year, but they had that similar route. So I think that was a change for them, and so we've tried to adapt, and John Paul has done an excellent job, and they put the service in place truly without funds as of yet. They're not being reimbursed for what they're doing. They did have the new buses, thank goodness that they had those on hand, but the response from the ridership was that they're CNG buses, and they're quiet, and they're very comfortable. They are very plush. They're very nice buses. People can appreciate that. Now we have to make sure that the ridership increases, that we get mass transit truly functional within the whole county and get people to Pittsburgh and back. And, you know, the fact for seniors of going into Pittsburgh for shows and so on, that those are all possibilities in addition to work, and then meeting the millennial needs and the younger group. What does that look like? They're still fleshing that out.
And that's what I wanted to touch on. How important is public transit right now, and what does it look like for Butler County in the future?
Well, okay, so I think everybody's talking about the fact that the main one of the main elements in the proposal for Amazon to move to any region was you had to have public transit, because most young folk don't want to drive. You're welcome, Tyler. Us old people in our jalopies. I think, you know, the younger generation, you know, you want to be working on your phone, your laptop, whatever, to sit in traffic for an hour and a half and, you know, do nothing but sit there is not something that most people want to do anymore. And so, you know, they're finding different ways to get there. The biggest challenge always is, as we talk about, is kind of this first and last mile. So it's one thing to get people around to a specific location where you have like major access and major arteries, but then to get them to the finite end destination is usually the challenge. So I think that's what we're going to have to work on going forward. It's one thing to get from Butler to Cranberry, Butler to Pittsburgh. The difficulty is, how do you get around once you get there, and how do you get to the place, your final destination? And that's really what we have to work on. But We believe that it is critically important to the future of attracting young people to the area. I mean, if you want to move to the Butler area and you know, have a nice place where you can afford as you're starting out as a young family, but you might have a job in Pittsburgh or you might have a job in Cranberry, and you know, it's much more reasonable for you to be able to get on that bus and take the bus to work, and maybe that means a family only needs one car, and it's much more affordable. Mm-hmm. And in today's times, I mean, that's really important to people.
You brought up Amazon. Mm-hmm. What have you been a part of any conversations there? What's the feeling in Western Pennsylvania that maybe it could come here? I saw they're on the top 20.
Right,
at least Pittsburgh
made it to the top 20. Certainly, our Community Development Corporation, as long with Mark Gordon, as we had mentioned earlier, have been on the calls with the Allegheny Conference as part of that proposal and, you know, offering up sites and potential locations, et cetera. I don't know. I personally, I have mixed emotions about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I do have mixed emotions about it, and just because from what we heard from,
and that's been a lot of the pushback is that Amazon, it's not a great place to work. You know, different things like that has been, at least that's what I've heard, and I've read that it's a difficult work environment.
Well, I think it's a different. Again, it's the change that's happening. It's that generational change from the company. The companies today are not the same as we saw. I mean, the companies in the past, they were ingrained in a community where they were. People lived, worked. Their charitable contributions were invested in that community. And now there's such a transient operation, you know, because folks come and go based on we used to have one job and keep that job our entire lives. And now, you know, people will have as many as 20 different jobs in
their
lifetime.
But do you feel like that can still happen, that businesses can come here and anchor down for 100 years in today's climate?
I don't know that I have the answer to that question, Tyler, to be honest with you, because I think things do change fast. I think we want to offer that opportunity for someone to come here and anchor down, and especially for what's most important is that we're able to keep the ones that are anchored down here.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to keep them from moving away, you
know,
from picking up and going, because that there's a reality in that conversation. I mean, some are saying, if we can't find employees, we might have to take our business someplace else. And that's a challenge the region is facing, is making sure that there's going to be a workforce here for the future. But back to your point, they have to want to come here, stay here, and live here. And you know, the question remains is how can we make that happen? And transit, obviously, is one of those pieces of that puzzle.
The commissioners have, not to change subjects here, but we're going to, and it's not really changing subjects. It's more an overall. You have three strategic objectives: excellence in government, aligning for and driving economic development and transportation, and integrating health, safety, and quality of life. We started this off with, have you accomplished your goals? Mm-hmm. How far are you along in these strategic objectives?
We are pretty far in depth, I want to say. I mean, we've addressed each one. We have made moves for the past 2 years, incremental moves toward each of these goals, and have achieved them in various fashions. For governance, we've been taking an active role in appointing people, specific people with backgrounds and talents and expertise and knowledge base for various boards and authorities, so that they're able to and emphasizing good governance and how important it is, because it all reflects back to the county. And one of the reasons why we set out to do that is when we first got into office, a lot of our boards have been not monitored in the past, the commissioners may have not had an active role in those boards and authorities. And we had some issues. We had some mismanagement and some, you know, various issues where there was some dysfunction. And in order to rectify that, we had to take a more active role.
I want to jump on that point a little bit, because people see the national political discussion. They see it even at the state level. How does that influence what you guys do on a day-to-day basis, or how have you turned government into what you believe is now a functioning, at least cordial, relationship?
It's important to remember your role. Everyone has to really remember what their role and their mission is, and trying to keep folks focused on that role and that mission. So in this process, you know, in a governance process, you know, we have a specific role to play in our office, you know, with the commissioner's office. And this is one of the things that's been difficult to learn and balance. The courts have, you know, their own role to play, and the row offices, the elected row offices also. So those relationships are interesting, and trying to balance that is interesting because there's autonomy in all of those places. Likewise with community organizations such as CDC, the college, et cetera. You're trying to get to a level of collaboration, but you realize that everybody has a mission, and hopefully, you know, people stick to that mission and you find ways to take your mission and bring your things that you do best to the table. When people start creeping out of that mission and into other areas, things get a little bit challenging. And I think that's part of where we're trying to get to. And remember what, you know, what is our role? How do we best plug in? And as far as internally, I think with governance, I mean, ours has been to be fit, you know, try to get the budget back on track, be fiscally responsible, be forward thinking and planning about for the future so that we're not strapping someone in the future with, you know, financial difficulties. And so, you know, we needed to restore cash flow to a positive level, which I think it looks like our fund balance at the end of this year is even going to be greater than last year's fund balance, which is good news. You know, we've been trying to review, align and update sort of the internal processes and procedures that have been a struggle.